difference is, well, the person has been in contempt of the court by remarks made of and concerning the court. That is a different type of contempt from that which we have here. We have here a situation which has been raised by motions of quash on behalf of Mr. Hamilton and Mr. Edmondson. We have a situation in which the constitutional guarantees of freedom of speech, freedom of press, contained in the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, are on one side opposed to the constitutional guarantees of right of free trial on the part of an accused being guaranteed to him under the Sixth Amendment to the Constitution of the United States. So far as I know, the Supreme Court of the United States has not yet attempted to define the boundaries of those respective rights. We do know, of course, that the American Bar Association has been interested in determining a proper course for the demeanor of counsel participating in criminal trial. It has been interested in determining the proper bounds beyond which the press should not go. And in pursuance of that interest, the American Bar Association has called to be considered this question by a committee, as the court well knows. And that report, returned by the committee, is generally known as the Reardon Report. It is my information that there has been consideration given by another committee under the chairmanship of Judge Medina, and that is known as the Medina Report. Counsel has mentioned a report submitted to the Judicial Conference recently. Members of that committee, so I'm advised, have worked 2 years or more in coming up with recommendations. That committee was chairmanned by Judge Kaufman of New York, and it is sometimes referred to as the Kaufman Report, and perhaps sometimes referred to as the report made to the Judicial Conference of the United States. Of course, the court well knows that that conference is made up of members of the federal judiciary, and this report, which I understand has been adopted by the Judicial Conference recently, has been made available to the public. Now, in view of the fact that we have no reported opinion from the High Court of the land, the best we can do at this time is to suggest to the court what our thoughts may be based on our construction of other cases decided by the High Court and based on these reports which have been submitted by these various committees who have been working for 2 or more years to make recommendations to the Bar Association and to the Federal Judiciary, the Judicial Conference, for possible adoption throughout the land in an attempt to solve this very troublesome problem of where the rights of one cease and where the rights of another begin. Of the friends of the court in this proceeding, and Mr. facts here adduced are guaranteed by their constitutional rights. This is a technical question. It would be beside the point, but perhaps not out of the way to comment that I think I could assure the court that there's no deliberate attempt here to ignore the rights of this accused and to do anything which would deny him a fair and impartial trial. Or for that matter, deny the state of Tennessee a fair and impartial trial. This troublesome problem, not directly related factually to the question we have today, but nevertheless related in the sense of a consideration of the court's power to hold one in contempt, was discussed by the United States Supreme Court in Bridges versus California, 314 U.S. 252. Also in Craig v. Harney, 331 U.S. 367, and various other cases. Those cases fall within the category previously mentioned of instances in which the press made slanderous or slurring remarks regarding the judge or attempted in some way to prevail upon the ruling of the court. We did not have there the case involved where an accused person had rights as opposed to the rights of the press. So to that extent, those cases are not in point, but they are in point to the extent that the court there discussed the power of a trial court the processes of contempt. Now, there's only one case that we know of in which the facts are reasonably similar to the facts in the case of Barr. And I say reasonably similar only to this extent that we do have here posed the question of the rights of the press on the one hand, as opposed to the rights of the accused on the other hand, those rights coming, of course, from the amendment to the Constitution of the United States. The case which we refer to as Baltimore Radio Show versus State, the Baltimore Broadcasting Corporation versus State, and Maryland Broadcasting Company versus State combined, and decided by the Court of Appeals of Maryland in 1949, cited as 67 Atlantic 2nd, 497. Now, as I said, the facts in that case are quite different than the facts here. Obviously, there would be, but there is a general similarity that we have the clash of the rights of those two persons or groups of persons under the Constitution. In that case, after there had been a series of stabbings in and around the city of Washington, on this occasion, a little girl was stabbed in Baltimore. And as the court points out, over a period of time, the apprehension on the part of the citizens of that area for the safety of their children was such that on this occasion, this little girl was stabbed. Great note was taken of it. And shortly thereafter, when a person was apprehended and arrested for the commission of a crime, of course, it was quite a noteworthy incident. The news of it and stories concerning it went out over the wires and over the radio. And it was given extreme publicity. While this accused person was in custody of the police officers and before an arraignment, he allegedly gave a confession to the commission of the crime. And that fact was given wide publicity over the radio. The publicity was such that when the accused was brought to trial, his counsel stated that the entire area had been so permeated by news of the alleged confession of his client that he despaired of receiving a fair trial at the hands of the jury, waived the jury, and his case was tried to the court without a jury. There was, in effect, rule number 4 of the rules of the Supreme Bench of Baltimore City, which provided that any of the following acts shall be subject to punishment as contempt. A, the making of photographs of the accused without his consent. B, the making of any photograph in violation of Rule 3 hereof. C, the issuance by the police authorities, the state's attorney, counsel for defense, or any other person having an official connection with the case, of any statement relative to the conduct of the accused, statements or admissions made by the accused, or other matter bearing upon the issues to be tried. D, the issuance of any statement or forecast as to the future course of action of either the prosecuting authorities or the defense relative to the conduct of the trial. E, the publication of any matter which may prevent a fair trial. Improperly influence the court or the jury, or attend in any manner to interfere with the administration of justice. F, the publication of any matter obtained as a result of a violation of this rule. Now, those were the rules which these accused persons, these defendants, Baltimore Radio Show and others, were accused of violating and were held in contempt by the trial court for so doing. Now, it is noteworthy here that Rule E, Subdivision E, is as follows: the publication of any matter which may prevent a fair trial, improperly influence the court or the jury, or tend in any manner to interfere with administration of justice, and F,